Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, hello, and welcome to Spirits and Spirits, where we use both definitions of the word. I'm Frank Todaro, host of the science and paranormal radio program, The Invisible World.
I'm Jack Duquesne, writer, herbologist, and a definite whiskey enthusiast. On this program, we're going to walk you through our visits to distilleries and really cool old towns around the world.
And in doing so, also investigate some of the oftentimes haunted history of those areas that all these distilleries are in, and in some cases, the distilleries themselves. So before we jump into the thick of things here, Jack, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about just what happens at a distillery and what a distillery is.
So the literal definition of distillation is the process of heating a liquid until it boils, then condensing and collecting the resultant hot vapors. Mankind has applied these principles of distillation for thousands of years. It was first probably used by ancient Arab chemists to isolate perfumes, even evidence of it 3500 BC. So with any alcohol, you need to create a reaction with specific ingredients, your recipe. So that could be malt, potatoes, hops, water, etc. It depends. So you do some very specific heating depending on what kind of spirit you're making, and this creates the wash. Now you ferment that wash with yeast. After that, you then boil the wash and evaporate out certain parts. So first you disregard what we call the heads. That's the first part that starts to boil off. Then you get to your ideal solution, and then you stop it right before you get to what we call the tails, and you disregard all of that. All very, very scientific. So once you've got this actual alcohol, you then take it, you age it, you flavor it, and you refine it and dilute it with water. So it's all purely science. So you can ferment and create alcohol out of so many different things. And then there's flavoring and aging in a myriad of ways. So we're going to go in-depth on the specific processes more and more each show. So, Frank, what are we going to learn about spirits?
Spirits. Well, if you guys are here, you probably know have a good idea of what the other definition of spirit is. I guess there's actually a couple different uses of the word spirit, but for our intents and purposes, there are two. But with each story that we go into here on the show, I'm not going to guarantee a Class 5 full torso free-roaming apparition. See, the key word here is stories. Every place has them. I would wager that in most historical sites or landmarks, were you to talk to a person who spent any time there or knows anything about the location's past, you'll more often than not find some strange tale of the unknown. Now that said, while it's less scary to name the monster under your bed, the truth of the matter is that we don't really know the truth. We categorize what we believe to be specific entities on the other side, but rarely get confirmation emails that we're on the right track. What we have are stories. Tales that are told and retold and sometimes take on a life of their own, morphing into narratives involving goblins playing ninepins in the mountains or an eerie specter that shows their face when you say their name three times. Sometimes, however, folklore finds its origin in true mysteries, real unknowns. That is exciting. On the show, I'll try to collect some of the stranger stories in each area we visit.
Also, this show is really about, you know, yes, traveling, about seeing spirits, about hearing great ghost stories that are local to the area, but it's also about exploring different alcohols in a completely non-pretentious way. And part of that will be us humbly trying new alcohols, telling you guys how we like it, if we like it, even if that makes us, you know, with the palate of a child.
So that means basically if we talk about the spirits that we're seeing while we're going through that, kind of question the author in that regard, because we might be a couple sheets to the wind.
And also, we will be making drinks with you on air. I really felt, and Frank agreed, that there's so much mysticism into the simplest of drinks. Like, beyond the fact that we can probably all master making a gin and tonic, it ends there. And it shouldn't be. So we're going to walk ourselves and you guys through some complex cocktails.
There's orange juice in that, right?
Yes. No. No, there isn't. So today we went to Tuttleton Distillery up in Gardner, New York.
Really cute fat cat at that place.
Oh, my God. I love Bourbon the cat. He's amazing.
We're going to post pictures of that, right?
So many pictures of Bourbon's belly. So many pictures. But also, we went to some cool historic places. One of them up in Cold Springs that Frank showed me.
I don't know if you can hear the soundtrack in the background. We're recording live from New York City.
Woo!
And that's the beautiful sound of the nature here in New York.
The constant noise. But there wasn't any noise in the beautiful woods of Cold Springs.
Great segue, babe.
Where we saw some amazing ruins that my man showed me.
Yeah, actually, for like the last like decade or two, there's this random giant mansion that has been burnt down years. It used to be really overgrown, called the Cornish Estate. Now, I used to hop down on trails from one side of the mountain, had no idea that it continued on to this different trail, because I just never bothered cutting through the brush. It's all clear now, and you can walk right up to these things, but we learned a lot more, as you guys will find out later.
And then we ended this amazing trip with visiting the oldest street in America.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Huguenots are some persecuted folks from back in the day, and they have a street here with quite a few buildings. It's old, and it's amazing, and we visited it.
Indeed we did. And we will get back to that later on in the program. But first, Tuttleton, my God, that was a magical place.
But one more thing. We're going to make old-fashions.
We are going to make old-fashions.
So if you guys want to make old-fashions with us, there are a couple of ingredients you'll need to gather. We'll tell you about them later, and then be fun, I think. I hope. Or you can just listen to us drink and make a drink. So we went to Tuttleton Distillery. That is in Gardner, New York, which is in just the sweet spot of the Hudson Valley in New York State. This is an amazingly beautiful area, very New England. It has its own Hudson Valley charm, really just quite lovely. So you go through winding roads and beautiful trees and water, and you come upon what was an old mill that has now been turned over into the distillery. So the people that bought the land bought it actually because of the amazing boulders and climbing areas around there. And they wanted to create like a rock climbing haven for people to come and travel to. But that didn't work out for various reasons. One being that the mill on the land is historic. So lots of factors getting in the way, some red tape, and then it turned into the idea of following another passion by making this whole place a distillery, and that is where Tuttleton has been born. That comes, that'll happen around 2003. So part of the challenges right out of the gate was that almost all of the prohibition laws were still in effect now in 2003. So though, of course, they were easily overturned, it's still a legal system. So it was a lot of appealing to get laws taken down, trying to get things changed, and it was a very lengthy process. And without Tuttleton making all of these efforts and becoming the first legal distillery since Prohibition in New York State, none of these, I mean, there are just a ton of distilleries now. Craft distilling is huge, and it is absolutely massive in New York. So none of them would have happened. So 10-plus years later, we have them to thank. Very, very cool. Very cool. So as they're doing this and they're going through all this legal battle, they are running out of money, but they're getting there. They're getting there. And one of the laws that they came across was that every single barrel they needed to create to age their bourbons and whiskeys had to always be new. Now, this is a law that's about 100 years old, and it has completely to do with making sure that the people that made the barrels stayed in business, which is very cool, but really really outdated, especially for the lack of barrel makers in New York. So very interesting. So that was a costly issue, and they had a really interesting way of you know, sidestepping it by purchasing the barrels, of course, but making them much smaller. Now this actually reduced the time it took to age, and if they could reduce the time it took to age it, which means they could get it out to be sold at a much quicker rate and have a quality product. This helped them to pay off the bills. So it was very cool, and that is where their baby bourbon was born.
If I might just step in here, it was quite tasty in the tasting section of our tour, which is worth the price of admission.
Oh my God, that and the cat. Did we mention the cat? The cat is 26 pounds of love.
See, that's enough to mention at least two more times, though, in the program, which we should post pictures too.
We will post so many pictures. I love Urban the Cat. I think he must have an Instagram. If he doesn't have an Instagram, Tuttleton Distillery, get an Instagram of Urban the Cat.
We were looking earlier today, and apparently Distillery Cats is kind of a thing. There are whole websites devoted to these famous distillery cats, which we're going to have to talk about on a later episode, I think, Jack.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So I want to stop and pause for a minute and talk about what actually is the point with the barrels. So like I mentioned briefly when we went over distilling, it's an entire process. You have all different things that go into the base of making of the alcohol, but then comes the flavoring and the aging. And with bourbons and whiskeys, that's all about the barrel. It's about what the barrel is made out of. It's about the amount of time that it will take, depending on the way the inside is charred, the size. All of these are huge factors. And what the alcohol is really doing is it is going in and out of the pores of that wood slowly over time, and the in and out with the moisture of the days and the years. So it's a very delicate process. But there's crazy things happening in order to create faster bourbon and whiskey. Now, there are many people out there playing mad scientists with the aging techniques, such as Tuttleton did with, you know, just thinking cleverly of using a smaller barrel. As distilling comes down to the science, then the flavor nuances, and often science, you can create the same result with many different unheard of methods. So some distillers are shaking their bourbon or whiskey years old in a matter of hours with chunks of chips of the barrel thrown into custom vats, which is just incredible. They're also culturing the bourbons from any carb or sugar base, such as beets, all the way to manufactured wood waste. And some are poetically setting them out to sea in a boat to age.
That's pretty cool. When we were up at Tuttleton, they actually sold chunks of their barrels to use to do your own distilling, right?
Yeah, they did. Also, if you just wanted a flavor. And there is a whole lot of things that you can do, just super easy, where you infuse at home. You don't need to worry about the possible, you know, of blowing up your kitchen with the pressuring of actually distilling. And you can create awesome flavors. And you can do that with these chunks of wood, as well as, you know, herbs, jalapenos, so on. So we'll definitely be going over infusing and making your own booze more. So Tuttleton makes a lot more than just their bourbon. They actually started out with apple vodka, and that was used from scraps that they got locally. Local sourcing is very important to them, which is a very cool aspect. They have a restaurant attached in the old mill that they cleaned up. It's right across the way from their really awesome shop and tasting area. So inside of the restaurant, they have all local sourced ingredients, a really cool cuisine menu of kind of American pub culture food. And then 80% of their ingredients for all of their booze, their botanicals, all of it is locally harvested, which is really great. They're working with local farmers, really kind of getting into and really living the concept of this craft and artisan distilling. So with that, they make so much. They make, you know, that apple vodka. They do a really delicious cocoa liquor that we had with their homemade grenadine syrup, which was amazing. It tasted like a cordial.
Very good, yeah.
They make their own bitters. They do a really beautiful, delicious, honestly delicious tasting gin that I would highly recommend. It's one of their newer ones.
I really like the absinthe that they made.
Yes.
That white absinthe. That was pretty good. They had a whole setup there with it in the water, so you can sort of lose it yourself, right?
Right. The water fountain. Yes, they had a water fountain, and what they had was called a white absinthe. So, very cool. It was really just a lovely flavor profile. I'm a big fan of botanicals. That's really the only thing I know anything about when it comes to booze, and absinthe is amazing. I'm not actually sure that you can buy it yet, because when we went, it was out for, I want to say, 2 weeks. It was brand new, and the promise from them that they're coming out with a green one soon. So I assume as soon as they're happy, like super happy with the formula, they'll be sending it out. And it is really amazing already. But because absinthe came up, I cannot help but dive into one thing that really bothers me about the botanical world.
Here we go.
Absinthe will not make you hallucinate. It will never make you hallucinate. The only real reaction you're going to have is probably due to its incredibly high alcohol content.
Well, there goes half the premise of our show, Jack.
I'm sorry, it's not true. Now, the only way that it could make you hallucinate, which is exactly the way it did back in the day, is if you mixed something called laudanum with it, or street heroin, opium, and then you put that in the spoon, you mixed it in, and then, yes, you might see anything. You might kill your family. That would be natural.
We're not going to do that on the show.
No, that is from the past, and Van Gogh can keep it, and we don't need it. And honestly, it's a shame because this is a beautiful botanical. It has an incredibly delightful flavor, in my opinion. I do like the licorice flavor. And what it does have, I also really love. So the only sort of magical, if you will, if you think anything that happens with botanicals is magical, this is kind of magical. So there is an ingredient that you probably have heard of, and everyone tells you that's what makes you trip out. And it's called thujone. And thujone occurs actually in a lot of herbs. It occurs in nettles. It occurs in mint. A lot of things that you're probably taking, especially in the alcohol world with botanicals. Juniper, even. That is a heavily used herb in gin. So thujone acts like what we call a GABA receptor. Now, these are receptors in the brain, allows in more blood. And really, without getting into the technicalities of how that works in the brain, the point is that it creates a focus and an ability to think quickly. So a lot of people, when they drink absinthe, one, they'll notice, whoa, that's a kick, because it's usually quite a high percent, usually doubling the amount of a normal shot of alcohol. It is also then giving you this ability of focus, which is quite a really fascinating feeling, because you're very alert and kind of aware, and yet you're drunk. So those cerebral, I find it really fun. I find it like really great for writing and being creative. I feel alert. It's probably all in my head, literally and metaphysically. But that's all it is. You're not going to see ghosts or spirits. You're not going to wake up dead or anything like that.
Now, you said a couple times you're talking about botanicals. Botanicals. Can you go a little bit further into that? Like, what's the difference between a botanical and any other type of alcohol?
Well, when you use an herb or a plant, spice, anything like that into a alcohol, you can just use the flavoring, which would be just a part of it, which would be, you know, flavoring something even artificially so, to have a strawberry vodka, if you will, something like that. Now, when I speak of botanicals, though that's my term, I'm not entirely sure what the booze world calls it, but what you're doing is you are creating the alcohol and infusing it with these particular herbs. So they're going to take on properties of that, much like they would with like an extract that you might buy at a health food store. So you're going to get flavor profiles and you're going to get active health profiles. And this whole use basically stems back to using alcohols as medicine. So what they call them, and the root, back in the day, even absinthe was one, is digestives. So
what are some examples of things that people might see in the average American bar, or wherever you're listening to this, that would be sort of akin to that?
Well, the most common botanical, if you will, would be gin. Obviously, pretty much 90%, if not everyone, has seen gin in a bar, whether or not you've tried it. And you can taste it. You can taste a very, you know, a profile of herbs. Now, some other ones that you might not realize are on the more fuller flavors or in the digestive realm would be Jägermeister. Absinthe, of course, is in that realm. And then there's some really cool specific things that happen in other cultures, which I will absolutely be going into deep, but you may not have seen them in your local bar.
We'll save that for when we fly overseas.
Woohoo! I want to also talk about our tour guide was a guy named Lion.
Lion,
you're awesome.
Like
you're roar,
as he said. So Lion, the awesome guy who gave us our tour of the distillery, turns out he's actually a paranormal investigator, or he belongs to some paranormal research group in town. So, weird coincidence there. Kind of our first trip out of the gate, and the universe is telling us to do this. Kind of cool.
So, also, this, you know, talking about coincidences with Lion. So, when we went to Huguenot Street, which, you know, we wandered around, we were getting the lay of the land first, and we're walking by some of these just really beautiful houses, this woman walking her dog just out of nowhere tells us, you know, oh, how she'd love to go into this house. And then moments later, as we're getting our tour tickets, another coincidence happens where they kind of miscommunication, and then they're bringing us straight into the house, though we didn't ask to. And that led to a really interesting revelation about something else completely coincidentally, which I'll let Frank tell us all about.
So a short drive away from Tuttleton, in the town of New Paltz, New York, lies what is said to be the oldest street in the continental United States. In 1678, a group of Huguenot families established a community in the Hudson Valley of New York, escaping religious persecution in Europe and establishing a new life here in the New World. Approximately 200 years later, in 1894, their descendants formed what is now historic Huguenot Street, where we visited. They put this together to protect that legacy in the buildings, the objects, and the stories they left behind. Over the years, some of those stories have a particularly haunting side. We traveled around the town and ended up taking two different tours. Now first, let me say, and Jack, I'm sure you agree, if you have the opportunity to check this place out, please do.
Oh, absolutely. The tours were so fun. And they're all really varied with what they offer. They all do different houses and in different ways.
Yeah.
So, absolutely.
Well, there are a few different ones that they had when they were offering at the time we went. Some were in full costume. They were like total immersion. You would go in and this woman would basically play a character. And if you spoke to her out of character yourself, out of the time period, she would just look at you with this quizzical look on her face. It was pretty cool. Kind of like playing a live-action RPG. So the first tour we did, which, Jack, you were just mentioning, is called the Deo House. Our guide, who was in full costume, by the way, told us about the history of the house from the point of view of a maid working during the turn of the century. Before we walked in the house, she said, "This is going to be a lot like Downton Abbey, so don't talk about anything that they wouldn't know." And we played along pretty well. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think so. There's definitely going to be some pictures later, but not too many because I didn't want to ruin anything. It's absolutely gorgeous in there, so I really recommend going on this tour when you get there.
And if you guys see anything weird in those pictures, just don't add anything weird in those pictures. Just let us know. Now, not much in the way of haunting, per se, on the actual tour itself. But later on, we asked the guide, out of character, if she herself experienced anything weird as she was giving tours over the years. So she regaled us with this story about this unruly group of tourists during one of their murder mystery tours. Now, this group got particularly rude. Apparently, they were asking weird questions, you know, like that one jerk at an improv show that raises their hand and says the dirty word because they're so much funnier than the guys on stage. Well, that's what these guys were doing, and just being jerks. So, as they're doing this, these disembodied banging. I say that for a reason. These noises started happening upstairs, and it seemed like there was some sort of intelligence to them. Apparently, whatever was up there was just as put off as the tour guides were themselves by the shenanigans of these unwanted guests. which I mean the tourists themselves. Now, interesting addendum to this story, this group, they were all together, had two people with wheelchairs. So they had them all stay downstairs, and the actors came to them. So nobody was upstairs. There was nothing going on, and everyone was accounted for. Who knows what was actually happening in that particular situation, but pretty weird. But Davey told us another story. Davey's the name of our tour guide. Really awesome. Make sure you ask for her if you're going on the Deo House tour, or whatever else she does. She did tell me another story that was of particular interest to me personally, because it involved the Cornish Estate, which we mentioned earlier. But more on that later. Our next tour guide, Amber, was dressed in a more contemporary attire, took us through the accurately restored Bevier House. Bevier House? How do you pronounce that in French?
I wouldn't know. I'm not French. But it's Bevier.
Sure, why not? Bevier House. The Bear House. Full of bears. And the meticulously restored... There's no bears involved.
There's no bears.
We had...
I wish there was bears.
There was an encounter with a bear in one of the places we went to, but you'll have to tune into future episodes to find out. Bears. So the Bevier House and the meticulously restored Abraham Hasbrook home. Now, she had some interesting stories to tell. You know what? Here's a clip.
A woman named Annie Dubois. One night, she lived on Huguenot Street. She locked all of the doors and all of the windows to her house. She jumped out of the top window, and then she came here, and she drowned herself. She just threw herself down the well.
Really?
I believe that when the love of her life, Hugo Freer, died from appendicitis, that she just lost her mind and couldn't live anymore.
Oh.
Some people think that she was even carrying his baby,
oh.
But she was 63 at the time, so probably not. But yeah, that's just a very strange mystery.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And there have been reportings of a woman at night standing here with a long white dress, just staring out across the street and sobbing.
Really?
So
people
right
have seen
this? Yeah.
Alright.
Mm-hmm.
In recent time, has the water ever been tested?
I'm not sure. I always wondered if it did, because
determine what was
if it's the same bacteria.
Or yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I've always wondered what it was.
Well, I mean, there's a dead woman down there, so clearly I wouldn't want to drink it.
Yeah, that's got to
no.
Be.
Jeez.
Popping up once in a while, staring across the street wistfully. Super creepy, staring off forever by the well. Really neat. Now, Amber did agree to call into a future episode to tell us more, so stay tuned for that. There's a lot of stay tunes happening in the last couple minutes. But it also brings up another story from the area. This is actually pretty cool. On a dark night, an old woman sat vigil at her husband's side, waiting for the town doctor. As he lay dying in his bed, the woman's sickly husband impatiently asked his concerned wife, "Is it here yet? Is it here yet?" Finally, there's a clip-clop, clip-clop, clip-clop sound of horses' hooves outside. The woman sighed in relief, believing this to be the doctor finally arriving to help ease her husband's pain. The woman looks out of the window, and to her amazement, she sees a black coach with no windows, no horses, and no rider. It finally dawned on her what her husband was asking. Somehow, he knew that his death coach, so to speak, was about to arrive. The distraught woman returned to her husband's side and held his hand tight. It was at that moment that she saw an image of her beloved leave his body as though his spirit were leaving as it floated slowly towards the door. The apparition turned to his wife and waved goodbye, and then turned to board the carriage. The death coach moved off into the darkness, the same clip-clop, clip-clop being heard as it vanished.
Yeah, it's spooky.
So that story's sort of bittersweet. Fairly straightforward, and you've probably heard similar ones before. Now, this next story of the unknown was even more disturbing, as it was apparently corroborated by real, documented events. This is another story that Amber relayed to us, and it happened in the Abraham Hasbrook House. The story was told by Hudson Valley author and Woodstock historian Alf Evers. No relation to the Melmacian idol of mine. Alf lived in the Abraham Hasbrook house with his parents. I love saying Alf on the radio. Can we rewatch Alf?
Yep, but no eating cats.
Now, Alf's mother claimed to be a clairvoyant. That is, someone who has a certain type of psychic ability. She insisted that there was a body of a child buried in the basement of their home. Now, we did, in fact, get to visit that same basement on the tour, and that is where Amber relayed this story to us, which was pretty eerie in and of itself, if you can guess the result of what this whole thing is. Alf's mom apparently put up such a fuss, prodding Alf, I'm just going to keep saying that name, prodding Alf and his father to investigate in the only feasible way to dig up the basement. There they made a rather gruesome discovery. You guessed it. The bones of a child buried deep under the basement floor of their home. What do you do in a situation like that?
I don't ever want to be in a position to, one, live in a building that is 400 years old that might have bones underneath it, so I'm hoping I will never have to know what to do in a situation like that.
Well, apparently, it's kind of like a self-cleaning oven, as you'll see here. They laid the bones on the table where the doctor declared them to be just what they thought, the bones of a child. Now, if that wasn't strange enough, the bones themselves simply disintegrated right there in front of their eyes on the table where they were laid. So, if we do ever find bones, just make sure they clean up after themselves. Now, in all seriousness, historians have postulated that perhaps these were the bones of an illegitimate slave child, as the basements of both of these homes, I think the Deo House too, were the slave quarters for the original Dutch inhabitants. But, with the very evidence turned to dust, this will forever remain a mystery. So, pretty creepy.
You know, I've actually seen, not that I'm saying this has anything to do with that, but I've actually seen some documentaries where they've talked about how bones can disintegrate after being unearthed because they were, for various reasons, protected from oxygen, and then being so old, now that they've been in contact with oxygen, they start to disintegrate into dust.
Way to show the man behind the curtain.
That is not the man behind the curtain. That's just like validifying this. This could literally have been true, which is very freaking spooky.
She did still predict that there was a kid buried underneath the building, and that is the crux of this story. These are just a few of the strange stories surrounding this particularly rich history of this centuries-old community.
But back to the weird coincidence. So first the woman tells us to go into the Deo House, then we go into the Deo House, and then we hear this incredible story of a place that we went and loved.
Well, I've been told that it was an old dairy farm, and so it's burned down now, because Cornish went crazy. So there's many different variations on who exactly consisted, who was actually in his family. So it was him, his wife, and I think the most accepted tale is that he had three sons. Mm-hmm. And there was just one day he went crazy. I don't know why. And he killed his wife. He killed his sons. And
wow.
There's actually a rock down the road from the old barn, kind of near where there's a shed too, where you can see three slashes, because the axe he was using to kill his son was not very sharp. And so one, it took three times before he, and that was when he killed the last of his sons, I believe.
Wow.
And then he burned down his farm. And what we say in camp to scare our friends is, if you see a red leaf on your pillow, Cornish is coming for you next.
Oh, that's awesome.
This is awesome.
Now
I have
not to go
heard
find
that
story
rock. At all.
I no,
think we should
I
go
didn't
to right
hear
now.
I know, we gotta find the rock. Maybe we shouldn't find the rock, actually.
I need
probably
to find
a
red
idea.
Leaf to put on your pillow tonight.
Oh, you do love me.
I do.
So there you have it. Now, this could be just a story that you tell at camp, the same way that she said. And when we get that other guy on the show, or at least try to talk to him, maybe send an email or something, we'll get some more details. But we did find corroborating stories online about that same camp that are told there.
Right. And I might add, if I ever see a red leaf on my bed, even as a joke, sir, I'm going to be a little freaked out because that is creepy. And we've also vowed to go back again and find the stone where the kid's head was hacked off 3 times.
Which probably isn't there, but we'll walk in circles for a really long time until we find a rock with some stuff on it. Here, just look at this picture of Bourbon the Cat. Look.
Bourbon the Cat!
Isn't he cute? Look at his belly.
Belly.
Look at his belly. All right. So, I relayed stories like that when I was a Boy Scout, when I was a kid. Who knows? We'll check it out.
So, before we get away from the Cornish estate and then we get into doing some drinks together, I want to say I got some really cool photos, and we're going to go back. We're going to go back to see, cross our fingers, that somebody has either hoaxed up a rock or that we find the authentic rock that this... That's really horrible to say that I'm looking for a rock somebody was murdered on. But it's in the name of spooky tales, not in morbidity. Anywho, we are going to go back, and we're going to go really deep into the history. But just so you have a very brief overview, this is 150-year-old, roughly, estate. It was actually the Northgate estate, bought by the Cornish family. And then the story comes from the Cornish family. The guy who originally developed it and designed it, they think, probably designed the very camp that this story has come from as well. However, they can't figure out who the designer is. So there's just so many mysteries. It's going to be really fun trying to dig into that. I'm also going to throw up some links to the original photos of what this whole area looked like. And like I said, we're going to go in way deeper, but you can get a little taste of it now, and we'll head back in a future episode to really dive in.
Ivo Shandor was his name, I think, the original architect. It's from Ghostbusters.
That was clever.
Hey, Jack.
Yes, Frank?
Check out this theme music.
What?
Right, what are we doing today?
We are going to make an old-fashioned. Now, Frank and I have been experimenting with the recipe on this, and this is a favorite of both of ours. And when we started trying to make it, about 5 months ago, we were okay at it, and then it went terrible. And then we got a little bit better, and then it was still not right, and then the bitters were all wrong, and we drank so many glasses of terrible bitters. Not that the bitters themselves were terrible, just the way we created the old-fashioned was a piece of crap. So I am here, and he is here as my witness, to say that this is actually a difficult drink to make, though it is only like 3 ingredients.
I'm getting some out of the cabinet now.
All right, so to the bar. So basically, an old-fashioned is really basic ingredients. It needs some sugar or simple syrup. It needs some cherry. An orange peel, ideally, which we'll get into, but you don't need it. And you need some bitters. We really do, speaking of which, enjoy the Tuttletons Frost Bitters. But really, just like a basic drinking bitters. So we're going to do a couple of versions of this. But first, the textbook old-fashioned. So you start with a old-fashioned glass, kind of a squat, wide glass. You could really substitute kind of a short water glass for that. You're going to drop a couple of sugar cubes. You can get those pretty much at any grocery store. Not that expensive. And the first thing is to muddle a couple of drops of your bitters into a saturated sugar cube in the bottom of the glass.
I, for one, am not too excited about this one because no cherry. I like the cherry. I feel like the cherry should be included somehow in an old-fashioned. But apparently, cherries are not very old-fashioned.
The sounds of muddling.
She's absolutely muddling.
Muddle. Kind of therapeutic, cathartic.
We're going to edit a lot of this out, right?
Totally editing most of this down for time, because this is kind of boring. So when you have muddled effectively, you'll be able to smell the bitters, which should be very pleasant, and you'll have kind of a sugary paste. Add 1.5 shots of bourbon or rye whiskey. Now, I am using the Wigwam Motel off of Route 66 shot glass that Frank bought me when I visited California last year. Any sweet.
Sweeter if we use cherries.
All right, so you add it. Super simple. Now you just fill the glass with ice cubes. You pour the drink over that, and you garnish with the cherry and a wedge of orange.
That is the sound of the ice going in the glass. This makes for great radio.
Whee! Okay, so before we try that, we're going to make... Frank is going to go ahead and make our regular version of an old-fashioned, as we've sort of, kind of, in our own brain and delusion, think we're kind of good at it.
All right, so first off, I'm going to put about 1/2 a shot of simple syrup. A little bit too much of that, but hey. It'll be a little sweet. Would you pass the Tuttleton bourbon, please?
Mm-hmm.
Really good stuff. Did you tell them about the maple thing yet, by the way? With the casks?
I've forgotten.
All right, and 2 shots of bourbon. Apparently up in Tuttleton, to get around that little law, they send the used casks up to Vermont, I think it is, to make maple syrup, and then send the back to...
Oh, do the liqueurs.
Technically, it was a maple whiskey, and it's okay because it's like they're buying them back again, I think. So their maple whiskey is totally built from a loophole, and I love it. Also, pass the cherries, please. All right, just a dash of bitters.
Perfect.
Okay. And I'll put a little more simple syrup.
No.
A little bit.
It's so sweet.
It's going to be just a tiny bit.
Sugar bomb.
Nothing.
All right, nice shake.
Nothing.
We shake. We like a shaken old fashioned.
All right. And for my version of the old fashioned, I'll be muddling the cherry. As is the modern version of it. It's a really difficult chair. Is this a piece of rubber you gave me?
Believe it or not, this is also like a natural cherry. So
wow.
of squishable cherries, this should be the most squishable.
Why?
And it...
This is non-biodegradable.
It is, I swear.
This is a force-sensitive cherry.
100% natural.
It refuses to be destroyed.
It's gluten-free. I don't know how it could have gluten.
Oh, my Lord.
But it is, the label says, no red dye.
I'm sure it's very organic. This is not an inorganic cherry in the slightest.
All right, pour, and we can toast.
All right. Here, take your stick. All right, let's drink. Me from my glass and you from yours.
But wait. First, a toast. My friends are the best friends, loyal, willing, and able. Now let's get to drinking all glasses off the table.
Oh, mine's delicious.
All right, swap. Yours is so sweet.
Yeah, it is.
But yeah, and that is an old-fashioned that you may or may not like.
I think we should mix the two of these together. Mine's a little too sweet, and yours a little too bitters.
That sounds like us. Oh.
God.
It does, doesn't it? That was a joke, but it's true. So, while we're drinking and reminiscing about our show with you guys, I wanted to say that we, of course, take it very seriously, drinking. Count your drinks, kids. Don't be drinking excessively. There is no race in drinking. Just drink to enjoy the flavor and drink responsibly. And don't be wasted, because that's just a waste of booze.
I like that it's a waste of booze. But in all honesty, yeah. And that's kind of why you learn how to make these drinks as great as they can be. Because you make one, you drink a small amount of awesome stuff rather than a mass amount of whatever.
Yeah, no junk.
Yeah.
And also, you know, be kind to your liver. It will thank you in the morning by not trying to kill you. Now, the next episode, we go to Brooklyn to the very first distillery in New York City.
So we're going from the first distillery in New York State to the first distillery in New York City. Lots of firsts here. And also next week, The Invisible World makes its triumphant return. We've got a full news program for you. So check out theinvisibleworld.info. That's theinvisibleworld.info, or check out facebook.com/theinvisibleworldshow.
Yay!
And I think that's our show. So cheers, everyone.
Cheers. Thanks for listening.
Everybody, everybody. I found a demonstration, told me so.